noche, meninos y meninas. That's good evening, boys and girls, to those who don't speak Portuguese. My day job has me working with a team out in Brazil, so I'm using every opportunity, including this podcast, to practice it as much as I can. So apologize for the broken Portuguese, but that aside, welcome to another episode of Hidden Apron Radio with myself, Paulo Espanola, where we talk to interesting yet ordinary people just like yourselves who are in the food space about what they do, how they eat, and their relationship with food in order to give you a better understanding of how food can enrich your lives, whether it be tactics, talking to people who are accomplished chefs, restaurateurs, food bloggers, anyone who's really in the food space. So I know the end of the year is coming up, and before I introduce the guest for this show, just one request, especially as we look ahead and plan for the next year and all the content that we want to bring. We have a very long list of people that we'd love to talk to, but I think one of the things that we would also like to ask is to you, the listener, if there's ever anything, any idea that you think, you know, this podcast really could be better if blank. Please, please, please let us know what it is that that could be, because this podcast really wouldn't be anything more than some random dudes sitting in their apartment making it. And it wouldn't really be of any use to anyone if we didn't listen to your feedback. Anyway, if you have any comments, please hit us up Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, hidden_apron, or email us hiddenapron@gmail.com. The guest for this week's show is Arun Motilal. And Arun Motilal is an entrepreneur who helps run his family business, Galaxy Foods, in Richfield, Minnesota, which has been operating for the last 28 years. They serve about 60,000 families a year, and they sell everything West Indian / Indo-Caribbean, from actual food, jerk seasoning, ginger beer, fresh meat, to lifestyle products and religious items. Prior to that, Arun worked for Target as a business process consultant for more than 3 years, and another 7 with Securian Financial Group before Target. So you may wonder, you know, why would he even bother covering a super niche ethnic, in air quotes, store run by a guy who wasn't really in it for all 28 years in a suburb of the Midwest not exactly known for the size of its Indo-Caribbean community? Well, here's why. Arun has the perfect combination of an economist, marketer, salesman, and philosopher. Not to mention, he's just a really cool guy. But when most of us think about launching businesses, we often plan for the perfect target market in the perfect location when we feel like we're ready. You know, think about that business case study that we often see in colleges or B school, and we plan for who our demographic is. And Arun isn't exactly operating in a market that we would normally consider as optimal. But I think that's really the interesting part, because it speaks to what most of us experience when thinking about answering a community need or providing a service, in that things aren't exactly perfect. Yet somehow he and his family have made it work perfectly. Just to get a little bit philosophical there. He doesn't overlook a single tiny detail in the whole conversation that when we're talking. And so there's a lot of valuable lessons here about how to actually market and present your business or passion, whether you're in retail or an actual restaurant, given specific constraints. And he really reduces these business complexities into simple truths. So if you feel like the term customer service or a customer-centric approach, because many of the spaces when it comes to food are inherently going to need that high level of customer service or customer-centric approach, if you think that's getting a bit too cliched and, you know, there really isn't much substance to the term anymore, definitely give this episode a listen. The other big part of our chat was dissecting this rarely questioned belief that all businesses must grow. And today, it almost seems un-American to question whether your business should grow. And I think it was very surprising to hear someone like Arun say, you know, our family would rather focus on making this one location the best it could possibly be versus figuring out, I don't know, some scaling plan, which many young companies often set their eyes on right out of the gate. Now, he clarifies that this doesn't mean they don't want to grow in other locations, but he has a much bigger focus on making this current location be the best it possibly can be. And I think that's a very philosophical angle on how we think about things like customer service or business growth and driving your passion forward. And I would argue that his mindset and approach is just as difficult, if not more so, as the usual, let's go 300% a year. And for me personally, it was a great answer to a question that I often think about, which is this: when is enough enough? And given our business climate, where stocks drop if you miss your earnings target by even just a few cents, I think it's a question worth asking. And specifically with food, there are a lot of implications here for what type of insight Arun is bringing to the table. Because when we begin to think of food businesses and food systems, not as this like gargantuan, hyper-efficient megastructure, but instead it's a collection of highly effective pieces, mom and pop shops, farms, restaurants, you name it, I think there's a lot to be learned from here. So throughout our whole conversation, we cover his background as a Guyanese and how that shaped his business. And if you've never even heard of the term Guyanese, well, perfect episode to learn. How the little things like product placement, packaging, down to how you stand in your store affects the overall customer experience. How to approach different demographics with the exact same products and services while still providing a unique experience. And of course, more of this human-centric approach to business. It's definitely one of the episodes that can apply to a whole range of people, no matter what interest you have in the food industry. Or maybe you're not even interested in the food industry, but just want to learn some really good concepts around business. Definitely, definitely, this is the episode for you. So, without further ado, once again with a very lengthy introduction, Arun Motilal. Arun Motilal, bow tie wearer, scholar, gentleman, master of all things suave. Did I get that right? Is that like,
man, that's just a lot. Thank you for reading off the cue cards. Well,
just as the police pass right behind you. Like, perfect timing. Like, we were just doing the sound check, and it was super quiet, and then a cop comes over. Well, either way, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start with getting the awkward questions out of the way first.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay? Let's do it. Take off my pants right away, right?
We're going there. I'm going to ask basically one of the most, like, I think, especially when we talk about, like, HR and companies and where you work for, one of the most ill-advised questions. Like, how do you answer when people come up to you and go like, what are you? Because you own a Guyanese / West Indian / Korean. Like, how do you answer a question when people go like, what are you? I think we should start there because that'll probably form the basis of a lot of the conversation.
Well, the crazy part about it is, like, I think answering that question has helped me answer what it is that I want to do in business, and like, or as the business morphs, right? So like the answer to your question is, when somebody on the street walks by and they're like, yo man, what are you? I say, I'm Indo-Caribbean. And if there's somebody that knows enough about the Caribbean and they want to be more specific, or they're like, oh, you're from Trinidad, you're from this, I would say, oh, I'm from Guyana. So, but the reason that I start with the larger bracket is I don't see myself, you know, I don't even want to answer it that narrowly, like, you know, like, as far as like being attributed to a specific area, because I think we're all humans, right? We're all the same, but we have this innate need to pigeon ourselves because you want to build relationships, but you also want to qualify people in certain places just so you can start to make sense of things.
Sure.
And Indo-Caribbean is probably the highest level that I can go with accepting and answering a lot of questions about myself. So what I mean by that is, normally when I say, oh, I'm Guyanese, they're like, well, there are black Guyanese too. There's Chinese Guyanese, right? So they're all Guyanese, but you look very different. You look like you're from India. So when I say Indo-Caribbean, that predecessor helps shut that question down right away. They're like, or answer that question right away. They're like, oh, you acknowledge the fact that you're of Indian descent, but you reside or were born in or lived in the Caribbean.
So what's the coming from the ignorant side of things? Because I didn't even know there were Chinese Guyanese. So how did that? What's the story? Like, how did the Indians get to Guyana?
Well, it's all, you know, everything. When you peel it back, you start to look at, like, everything is based on economics. Mm-hmm. It's just fundamental. Like, and to not acknowledge that would be to, like, just be blind. And that's where you have to say, you know what, it's based on economics, and that's how it worked, and that's, we're going to embrace that. So when people went in search of natural resources or land, whichever was their direct, you know, search, they would find things, and then they would need resources, people. So there are many stories that say that, you know, the English or the Spaniards or the Dutch, those were the three big colonizers at the time, mm-hmm. That people were going in to them as indentured servants. Some people were going in as slaves. I think it's probably a mix of the two. You know, there were some people that were making contracts and they're like, I'll serve you for, you know, as a worker for X years, and then I will be free. Then there was just some pilfering, right? They were like, yo, we're just taking slaves, right? So I think it's a mix of those. But so however you want to tell this, people want to tell their stories, up to them. I'll be honest and say, you know, it's a mix. And what happened is for us, the British, who had colonized India, were moving across the globe. And as they got into the, you know, Western hemisphere, they needed bodies to do work, basically. So the biggest line of work in the Caribbean at that time was sugarcane fields. And, you know, so that's like the number one export for, you know, brown sugar, and which is why rum is so popular, because cane juice is the input for rum. It's both a privilege and a curse of our society, right? Because alcoholism runs amok. That's a whole different podcast, if you will, or just like it's an interesting tilt to our, you know, our fortune see. But the thing about it is, like, the funny thing about it is, like, they started with the Indians, or I don't know if the order is correct, but Indians were one set of servants. And let's just be honest, man, we are not bred. Indians were not bred as, like, the strongest race, if you will, physically. So either we couldn't cut it, they needed more bodies, whatever the case was, they started to colonize other places. So they started bringing in Africans, particularly West Africans. Mm-hmm. So that's how you end up with the Jamaicans. Like, what I learned is most Jamaicans, most Black Caribbeans originally are from West Africa. They're not East Africa, not North Africa, not South Africa. You're talking about Ghana, Nigeria, Liberia, Ivory Coast. Like, it's a handful of countries that were run by the British. And then the Chinese, I don't know how many of the Chinese came over, but I know the Chinese culture it runs deep there. So that there were Chinese, and it was specifically Chinese, which is funny because the racist jokes that we always tell, like, I always tell people that, like, yourself, Paolo, or Dave, I remember when Dave Choi came to my parents' house, or anybody that's East Asian but not Chinese, I was like, look, man, you're Chinese. Like, when I introduce you to my grandmother, I'm probably gonna say that you're Chinese,
because it's easier. Because if I,
right, because if I'm like, you're Korean, they're gonna be like, oh, he's a Chinese kid, right? And it's so funny because it actually played out that way. Like, I introduced Dave, I was like, oh, here's my friend Dave, he's from Korea. They're like, and then when Dave left, they're like, who's a Chinese boy again? And like, that's all they know, right? So that's how it came there. And that mix of the food culture is crazy, which I know we'll get to a little bit later. But, like, that's how the hodgepodge ended up there. And then there's the natives. There's many terms that go around for them. Like, well, there's native, there's buck people, there's Amerindians. Amerindians, that's, like, they're probably the most politically correct and culturally accurate name. And they're the ones that live, you know, deeper in the rainforests. And, you know, you hear a lot more and see a lot more. But there's not a ton of them that you experience on a daily basis, just because of where they live and how they live.
I think it's interesting that, and this is a good precursor, a good omen that this interview is going to be really good, because you started with explaining that the story is driven by economics. Because I think any normal person, if I just asked them, like, I'm pretty sure they would have just said, oh, slaves, we came over as slaves. And you went through this whole thing about, like, well, it's really driven by economics. So I think it's a good context for explaining what I think is one of the most, and I mean this in a very good way, confusing backgrounds. Oh, yeah. Because if you remember when you visited New York and we went to Little Guyana, like, I couldn't wrap my head around the cuisine, because I'd sit down and be like, oh, completely Indian. Like, I see something here and it looks like a jalebi. Like, this is Indian. And then I go down the aisle and there's like this chow mein sauce with like a little Chinese guy at the front. I'm like, wait, what? What's the... You know what I mean? So I think that's a good segue into it, considering all this, right? The background of how this abridged version, obviously, of how the people got there. How would you describe the cuisine of being an Indo-Caribbean?
So this is where I take a lot of pride, actually, in being Indo-Caribbean, because I believe that we have melted together food, and that's part of our culture, right? So, like, there is racism, there are struggles, but that's true everywhere. But, like, it's the food, I would say, is a hodgepodge of cliche cuisine specific to the areas that I just described. So, like, cliche Indian food, cliche Chinese food, and cliche African food mixed then with our own Caribbean flavors, the resources that are there. So I'll give you an example.
Right.
So, like, when I go to an Indian store, I don't have a fucking clue what 90% of the stuff is that they use. I'm like, I don't know what that is. We use, like, two kinds of dal. Right? That's all we know. So it's like we've gravitated towards, like, very, very niche items. For the Chinese food, same thing, like noodles. Chinese noodles are like what we eat. It is a staple, right? But I don't know any other, like, you know, you go somewhere and you get me like a Szechuan dish, I'm like, I don't know what that is. Like, that's not familiar to me.
Yeah.
Right? So again, and then the last example would be from the Africans, like fufu. I did not realize that was actually very popular in Guyana, but it is. It's like a mashed plantain dough. And that came from Africa, like the tools used to make it. So we eat it. It's funny, like my grandmother, it's more of a traditional type of dish. Like my grandmother would be like, oh yeah, we used to pound fufu and like, we'll do that. And I'm like, oh my God, well, that's straight up African. Like that, there's nothing about that that's not African, right? And, but then we've melted it a little bit to make it our own, right? Because you've got the local spices, the local things that are going on in the area. But we stick to those dishes, so we don't deviate very far from them. So I would say the cuisine is like these four or five items that are very cliche to it. And the last one actually is we borrow a lot from the Amerindians, which I don't think we give enough credit to, because there are very typical dishes that are made of like root products, you know, like cassava or plantain, which is not a root product, but that are how they manage to like live in the world without doing harm, but with keeping food edible that you couldn't refrigerate, you know, or heat up. So like, we've got dishes that are still made this way. And I ask questions about it. I'm like, how is this dish able to stay out? It's meat and it's sitting on the table for 4 days and it only tastes better after 4 days and it doesn't go bad. Like, how is that possible?
Are you using a lot of vinegar?
What we were using is what we call kazrip, which is like it's like molasses. Puree from the cassava that's burned, then that becomes black, and it adds like a sweet flavor, but it kills bacteria.
So it's a charred cassava product.
Yeah, it's actually it's a liquid. Like, I don't know how to describe it. It's like a molasses.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think that's a thread that I've seen with other cuisines too, is like, how do you preserve something prior to refrigeration, right? Because in the Philippines, same thing. We still do this today, where if you don't have a refrigerator, the food is actually left out and it does get better. But the way we've solved the issue of preservation is through vinegar. So it's almost like pickling, whereas...
Yes.
The Koreans with kimchi, it was through fermentation. You know what I mean? Like, we've fermented.
Interesting.
Too. So this one's new to me. This what did you call it?
Well, kazrip is what we call it.
Kazrip. How do you spell that?
Kazreep.
And so do you buy that nowadays? Do you buy that as like a bottled product?
Yes.
Ah, okay. So you could buy this as a, and it's specifically in like Indo-Caribbean stores.
Yeah, like you will only find it in our store. Like, I don't know very many, or like stores like ours. Like, you're not going to be able to. That's a very, very, when somebody's coming in looking for that, it's very niche.
You talked about how your family started, and if you want to like add a little more context to this, definitely do, because the way you explained it to me is like your family came over here many, many years ago. They saw a need in the community who wanted products like Kazrip, couldn't find it. And so that's how your business started, right? I'm probably oversimplifying it.
No.
I know that's almost like a cliched story of like the immigrant family comes here, sees a need, fills that need through something and grows it. Yeah. But how would you describe, especially your family business, when it comes to groceries? And I think this question applies to other so-called ethnic stores. What makes yours different from someone just saying, oh, you're pretty much just the ethnic aisle, except you just built a store out of it?
Well, I think that
like a fair comparison, or is there a fundamental difference between stores like yours that are filling a need?
Yeah,
you know,
that's a brilliant question. I believe there is, and to be honest with you, I don't believe that every customer is going to believe that, and maybe that we will change some minds with people that experience it. But at the end of the day, you know, that's why we do business. And I think some of the key separators from that is you'll notice that in service, because like, again, at the end of the day, you can go get these products in other places, right? There are some of these products that could be found at a Super Value or a large American grocer that has it in their Caribbean aisle, right? In their 12 foot of run, they're going to have that particular product.
Sure.
What you're not going to get is the authenticity of it. Now, it might be the same product, so I will say that the product will be authentic, but the experience is not going to be authentic. You come into our store, and I'm not kidding when I made a joke. I was like, I think I've used almost every product here. And then I walked around. I was like, damn, that's not an overstatement. I think we have used regularly, or at least have tested every single product that's in this store. So you're going to get a very different experience when you come in and someone's like, hey, I want to make jerk chicken, or I want to make chow mein. Like, how much long bean do I need? How much of this chow mein seasoning do I need? Like, how many packs of noodles do I need? Like, what's the right chicken ratio? Like, you're going to get a very different experience, because I'm going to be like, oh, well, you know, last week when we made it, we used this, or we tried this one, you know? And I think that credibility is like, it's priceless.
Which, by the way, is a very old school approach, because like a purveyor, if you will, knowing his or her products, it's very, not that old school, but it reminds me of like very small mom and pop shops. I wonder, just to set the stage, like how much product are you carrying in your store in terms of like number of SKUs, I suppose?
You know, honestly, I don't know. It's a lot more SKUs than I think. I mean, there's got to be like 10,000 SKUs in there.
Interesting. Okay, so it's not just like, oh, I carry two types of spices and one meat, and so of course I'd know what I'm using. You
know? No, no, it's actually become a lot, and it's become a lot more over the last couple of years. Like, we've really gone deep into our culture and just started bringing like a whole ton of stuff, and that's made it fun at the kitchen table. As we're like, oh, try this one, try that, this is new, try this. But it's also made it fun in like the cultural experience that we're having with our customers, because there are things that are not inherently Indo-Guyanese that we're starting to use. And like the Jamaicans are like, yeah, this is how we prepare it. I'm like, oh shit. Like, I've never had, you know, like, they're, again, we're all one, but they're still unique. They're still unique dishes, right? So they're like, this is how we eat it. And my mom will literally be like, I'm going to make that. Like, talking to some Jamaican woman that comes in the store, like, how do you prepare that? We're like, oh snap, let's try it.
I think that's like almost the I guess my naive utopian version of what life I wish life could be like. Because the other end of that conversation is often the favorite story that I always bring up is this research paper I read in college of this guy was trying to prove who owns or who invented hummus. Like, is it the Palestinians or the Israelis? So that's already, one, a touchy subject to bring up. And two,
to
not have picked like the two worst potential people to like research the topic on. Because that question will never come up. The question won't be like, oh man, let me learn how you do it. It's going to be like, oh, I'm going to prove that I do it this way.
And yeah. So,
you know, I love that you brought up the connection of two different people who share that thread.
We try to. I think one of the things that's different about our story, we really, and it's just a blessing with my family to have them and to be surrounded by them. Like, pride is a plague sometimes, right? Like, I'm not going to sit there in my store and fight with you that you were the ones that discovered X or Y, or that you made it better than the other person. Like, quite frankly, I just really don't care. Like it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is that, hey, we've got this experience that we're now sharing together, or that I want to try, or that you want to try. You know, those battles that were fought or whatever they were, that's history.
Sure.
So I think, but to go back to your question, I mean, I think again, it's that experience is, it's both our fear and our joy. And I'll answer kind of, people might automatically be like, what do you fear? Well, the thing is with growth, we fear like not being able to have those interactions. And it actually has become a small conversation piece around our, you know, when we're with our family, to be like, hey, really want to be able to make sure we're spending more time engaging with customers because we love it. So like, can we find a way to do some operational things more efficiently so I don't have to be doing so much and I can be interacting more?
Right, right. And actually save that in the bit, because I'm actually going to go into that, because I was reading an interview you had done and you kind of said something that I wasn't expecting. I think in this day and age, everyone talks about growth, growth, growth. And you're pretty much the only one I've seen who's like, no, we're going to focus on this one store and making it the best. So I'm going to save that for a bit. And however, I do want to get into a little bit of the operational side. So you're in the business of not just food, because this is really retail, right? Because you sell other stuff in your store. What are some things that people don't know about your business or industry? And you could define what you think your business is, whether it's just retail or whether it's specifically, I don't know, lifestyle. Yeah. What are some things that people don't know about your business or industry?
Well, what I don't think people realize, actually, let me rephrase that. What people do not realize, and I know that this is a fact because they've said it to me, is they believe that businesses like this, any kind of retail, you could be selling widgets, you could be selling fish, you could be selling vegetables. When you're running a store, a single or a small operation store, what people view as that, they don't realize the extent of the work and brain rigor required. And now I'll explain to you in a story. So it's very common that I'll be at the cash register and, you know, one of like an auntie or uncle will come in and they'll be like, oh, you're helping out today. And I'm like, oh yeah. Yeah. Sometimes for ease, I'll be like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Or I'll be like, no, I mean, this is what I do now. I'm here to serve you guys full time. And they're like, oh, didn't you go to college? Right? Oh, like, didn't you used to work at Target?
Yeah.
Right? It's so they, and it's not like there's a class difference, like people looking down on you, but I think they fail to realize that these businesses, I have so much respect for anybody running any one of these types of establishments. It could be the local coffee shop I just walked out of, or selling t-shirts at the, you know, the store down the street and birthday cards. Right. Like, these things, they require an immense amount of not only commitment, but like thought. They draw a lot of energy. And I don't know that people see that. And I think partially we don't show that as well. It's not, you know, we don't want to walk around complaining about how hard it is. So people just don't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can definitely sympathize, because, My grandfather is also in retail, and oftentimes, like, when you see someone behind the desk, you're like, oh, they're just one of the store staff, you know?
Yeah.
But they don't often think of, like, dude, some of this product has to come all the way from China, that we have to work on the purchase order and the logistics, and, you know, storage.
Yeah. The thought crosses my mind a lot, actually, about perceptions, and I struggle with it every day. I really do, and I don't know when I'll get better about shutting some of it off, or like managing.
What do you mean? Like, it bothers you? Like it? You wish the perception wasn't there?
Well, so like, here's what I mean. Like, when I could be working in the store and it could have been like slam ram packed right for the last hour and a half, and everybody's tired, exhausted. But if, what do you think when, let's say, that crowd has left and you walk in and you see me on my phone texting, or you see me on my phone like posted up at the counter? What's your first thought?
Dude, you've just been lounging all day.
Yeah,
exactly. Right. I'll be honest.
Yeah, exactly. You're probably like, man, he's probably on Facebook because he's young, you know, or just chit-chatting with some girl trying to spit game, you know, like, that's, but what it probably is answering some supplier, some customer that needs something, checking, you know, inventory. Like, it's it's always, it's 99% of the time, if you bet it's work, you're going to win money on that bet, yeah. right? And it's coming off the heels of something that was just incredibly demanding. People don't see that. And I worry about that perception, right? Because perception matters, right? It matters, like, if people think we're just chilling when they come into our store, or it matters if they see us working. And I don't want to think too much about it to be rigid, but I also do, you know, like, I just think about it. I don't know that I'm really taking action, to be honest with you. I'm just, the thought just pops in my mind. Sometimes I just put my phone down because I'm like, you know what? I don't want people to think that, but then my work doesn't get done. Then I go home at night, and this is what happens to us. We all go home at night and everybody works on their laptop because they don't get computer time, because when you're sitting behind the computer, people think you're just chilling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I don't know if that answer can be solved of, like, the perception, because you're it's like almost being caught between a rock and a hard place, right? It's either,
oh yeah,
you act on it to change the perception, but that ruins the customer experience, or, you know what I mean? Like, you almost kind of want to make it look like you're not doing anything, almost. And I feel like that same issue comes across with restaurants. Like, oh, like, you're just a waiter, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but, yeah, absolutely.
Have you tried to cover 20 covers over, like?
Yeah, right. And like you said, man, I'm not sure. We're not in the game of, like, making people believe that we do work, right? Like, it happens to me, but I think because I'm a little more conscious of it, like, when I walk in and see, because I'm in the industry, like, when I walk in and see somebody at the coffee, you know, the barista, you know, maybe taking five or looking under the, or looking for something, I know that probably my best bet is to guess they're probably doing something constructive. And that's also just human nature. Like, I believe in the positive side of people, so I'm not going to think that people are just lounging and chilling, which gets me in a hard place sometimes.
Right.
But I'd rather believe that people are doing the right thing, or, like, you know, if they need a break, it's probably because they need an actual break. Like, you know, we're not machines, right? So people have the right to sit down or chill out. And
it's very, you know, very non-corporate of you to say that.
Yeah, I mean, I think corporate America is coming around a little bit, but they're just not. I don't know if it's again, it's about being authentic on it, right? I think they bring yoga in, they bring instructors, they bring all these things, but I don't know that people find it all to be like, are you really doing it because you care about me, or do you really just want me to be more productive for your business?
That's another interesting conversation to have. Actually, the podcast episode. Couple podcast episode when this comes out, but I covered that where I read this interesting book called Three Squares that actually explained that a lot of the things around food that we do today in America were all based on productivity, actually. Like, to your question of, like, do you bring yoga because you just want me to work better? I won't derail the conversation, but the concept of lunch was actually invented because of productivity. Like, one of the things I read was that lunch actually didn't exist in America before, until, like, Industrial Revolution.
Really?
Yeah. I always took it for granted, like, oh, lunch was always a concept. But actually, in America, it was always dinner happened around noon or 1 p.m. And this is still true in many agrarian societies where, like, the fields would be too hot, so you go home, you have your heaviest meal, go back to work, come home, and you eat the leftovers. So there was no such thing as lunch. However, when the Industrial Revolution happened, there's all these offices now. It's like, okay, well, they can't leave work because now they live super far, but we also can't give them, like, 3 hours because if they eat a heavy meal, they're going to go into food coma. They invented lunch. It's why you have brown paper bag lunches. It's why you have cafeterias. Cafeterias were invented so that people could eat somewhere at work without damaging the machines. And so, I know this is a complete tangent, but, like, to answer your question, it's completely true. Like, sometimes they bring this in because it's a productivity. It's the conversation starts from, can we make this a more productive workforce?
Right. Huh. Interesting. That's crazy. I got more to tell you about industrialization. The industrialization of any society has really had a lot to play in why things are the way they are.
Right. And going back to that question of growth, I think this is why your statement, see how I did that segue there?
Yeah, man, I got you. I like that. See,
and that's why I think it's really stuck out to me, because what you said, and I'm gonna read the quote that you had in the interview you had with what was it? Dish drink.
Eat, right? Yep.
Really stuck out to me, even though I should have expected it, because the person asked you, you know, what you're focused on, and you said, oh, we really balance growth. Like, growing isn't our mission. Serving people is our mission. And if you grow as a result of that, then great. which is very counterintuitive. Everyone's always asking, like, what's your growth plan? What's your year-over-year growth rate on revenue? Like, was this your thinking? Or how, what's the story behind this? How did you come to this answer?
Well, I mean, the truth of it is that through experience with my family and myself, I've just realized that you can't kill yourself to grow, right? I think when we're all young, we've all been caught up, and this doesn't even have to do with just this business, but like it could be with anything. Like, oh, I want this fast, I want that fast, I want this fast, and you just start falling on your face. And I think what I've realized is that for me and for our business, like truly serving the customers and making sure that people are happy with the interaction and the quality of the product is fundamental. We just happen to be at a place right now where financially we're comfortable. Like, we're not in a great place, but we're also not in a horrible place. Mm-hmm. Meaning we're able to feed ourselves and feed the people that work with us. And like, you know, people are happy, but is there more opportunity to quote unquote grow financially? Yeah, there is. But I just think that you've got to flip the way you look at that, right? My perspective on any of these types of things is I'm about, and we're about, this interaction and this human behavior and this human interaction and this behavior. And there are things that result from that, but far too often people get the result confused with the reason. Mm. And that's where, when I took a step back and thought, like, why am I leaving my corporate jobs? Why don't I just go get another one? Why is my family here? Like, why do we do any of this? It's not for profits. Again, we want to be able to live, right? So I think that, but that's a basic Maslow need, right? Like, we just want to be able to survive.
Yeah.
And people have different definitions of survival. You know, for some people, Maserati is survival. For some people, a Mercury Cougar is survival, right? But I'm not gonna split hairs here. I think what just mattered to us is like it was almost like a philosophy of like, if you build it, they will come. Like, if we just do good, I think good will be attracted to us, and we hope and pray and thank the world that there's enough stuff that'll come to us from that. And if it doesn't, at least I know that we did it for the reasons that made us happy and for the right reasons. And when we look back on it, it's not a failure of our own. It's a failure of potentially maybe just other things. Maybe you're just not in the right economic situation. Maybe you're just not leveraged well enough. Maybe you're just not in the right, located in the right area. I mean, when I look back on my life, I don't want to say like this business failed because you were immoral, because you had your profits over your customers, or like that I can't sleep with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That's just really hard, but that didn't come overnight. I actually think I got a lot of the you know, Simon Sinek, kind of like his philosophies.
Yeah.
You know,
for the listeners, who is Simon Sinek, or which talk did you listen to?
Oh man, what was it? I can't remember his talk.
Start
was
with
it called?
Why or
start with why? Start with
or something like that.
Yeah, start with why. With why. You know, so I saw that a few years ago, and that kind of helped me on the trajectory of asking myself a few questions. I think I've always asked myself, but he did a really good job of synthesizing it. And he used examples that like really big companies that people grapple with, like Apple is, you know, the most iconic company to use in this example. Mm-hmm. But that example is attributable to many companies. And then when I look around, when I also looked around at like even some of my competitors, quote unquote competitors, when I listen to their employees tell me stuff, because, you know, we do some wholesale. And when I go in and we sell to these businesses and we talk to them, I hear them saying things like, you know, these people are like just money hungry, they're worried about this. So there were constant triggers that let me ask myself, like, what are we really doing here? And right. Why do we do any of this?
It's a very, very philosophical, almost existential question. But I think the way you put it makes a lot of sense. I think initially when I heard it, you know, going back to what we were talking about, industrialization, right? Your narrative, to be honest, just doesn't fit. Right.
Well, and I
think about corporates, they're always asking, if you didn't hit your growth target, then what exactly are you doing? And so I have actually grappled with that question and struggled with it, because at some point, when is enough enough? Like if you're fulfilling your mission, why do you need to grow? And that question often, like asking why to that is often almost like, it's almost anti-American. It's like, well, what do you mean? Why aren't we growing?
Yeah. Well, and I think growth, again, this is, we are an extension of the businesses and the things that we run, right? So like for me, growth, yes, it would be great to have more locations to make it easier for customers to come and shop our stuff or to be in more stores. Yeah, those are going to result, as we said before, to kind of bring it full circle. They may result in more financial rewards down the line. But the thing about it is, how much do I want to stretch myself personally? I've got to remember that as well, right? Like when you grow, you've got to be ready personally to grow. So now I've got to tell myself, am I ready to split myself between two locations? Am I ready to spread myself around three locations? Like, how much can I do? And I think for our family, what we have said to ourselves is, right now, if somebody were to come to me and say, like, Arun, we want to bring 10 more locations and we want to put them all over and you're going to make, you know, $5 million next year alone, I would not do that. Now, I might tier that strategy out a little bit, but what I would, you know, if I want to engage in a conversation with somebody, but what I will say is, like, really in the business to just do a good job. And I can tell you right now that if you threw all that at me, I would fall on my face. And falling on my face is not what I want to do every day. So yeah. I'd rather just do a really good job. And if that means that our store never is able to serve more people than the people in our community and the people that come to us, well, hey, that's just what it is, right? But I also believe that you have to push yourself. So there's the right time for that, right? Like, you do want to stretch yourself personally, which also comes from stretching yourself professionally. So maybe there will be a time where, like, growing more will mean that I get to grow more personally, but those two things have to happen in tandem.
Right. It's not growth for growth's sake.
Right. And yeah. I actually just had a growth situation happen that I divested of. I told my parents of. I'm like, I'm out. Can't do it. They're like, we can push through it. I'm like, not going to happen. It's just too much. I can't deal with this. You know, this is not why I'm doing this. Otherwise, I'll just go work somewhere else, right? I'll get another job. Like, you know, if I'm not happy doing this, and if I'm not doing a good, what it really boils down to, Paul, is like, if I'm not doing a good job, if I'm not going home and feeling like I killed it that day, or at least just feeling content with what I did, that's a really, really uneasy feeling. That's generally why I don't go home early then, right? I'll stay until I feel like I'm at the right place or we're at the right place, and then we go home.
Right, or the dangerous situation becomes where you start justifying why you're doing it. You know what I mean? Like, you're justifying your existence. And I think a lot of companies, you know, I think the flip side is they end up doing that. It's like, well, we're no longer relevant, but we're going to justify why we are. And that's
right.
A more dangerous position. Wow, we the existential part that was supposed to happen at the end of the usual interview went smack dab in the middle. I feel like I'm too sober for a conversation like
this. I did
this interview where, like, I had like two gin and tonics prior to it, and it was like the whole thing was like a philosophical debate. So maybe this is just me, like, our relationship with each other that somehow went to that. But I wanted to slightly pivot a bit, talking about service, because you said serving people is your mission, and I want to talk about the people you're serving. So you mentioned that in the same interview that I'm referencing, that your operations today serve three primary groups of people. There's like the people who are like recent immigrants who just moved and they're missing home. There's the second generation who maybe their household still acts like that and they grew up in that environment, albeit in Minnesota. And the third is people who have traveled, they come back and they're like, man, I want to recreate this experience that I had. Have you found a big difference between those types of people when they buy your products? Like, in terms of not just what they buy, but the narratives that they bring when they engage you?
That's a really interesting question, but a great question, actually.
Yes and no. I think what we see is that that's a really interesting question. So I'm going to start with the middle group. Mm-hmm. So that middle group, those people that have been raised, like, they're the younger generation, they're raised in a household that was similar to that, you know, kind of with a foot in both worlds, if you will.
Yeah.
They shop brands, right? I'm one of those people. So, like, what I mean by that is, when I go in, I will not deviate very far from what I know unless you've told me a really good reason. So what I mean by that is they're like, hey, I'm coming in, I'm looking for this brand of ginger beer. Oh, have you tried this one? No, but this is the one we used to drink at home. This is the one my mom always gets, right? Like, that's all we want, right? Mm-hmm. So they shop, like, they're married to brands. And that process then, if you're going to have a conversation with them about an alternative, it requires education because they're so married to that brand. Whereas, that shopping experience for them is also very much like going on a, it's very much like going down a list. Mm-hmm. So they're like, I'm going here for that, I'm going here for that, I'm going here for that. They don't meander, right? The older generation, those who lived in Guyana or, you know, came here very late in their life, they meander through the store because they're, the way they cook and the way they think, I'm generalizing here, is they're kind of just looking. Oh yeah, 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 I know this one. Oh yeah, I know that one. They're going to grab their cliche things, their normal basket items, but they're going to deviate a little bit or be like, oh yeah, we used to use this. How would I do this one? Or I've tried this fish before, but maybe something different. So like, they're going to be slightly different in how they kind of move through the store. Wow, and even the conversation is going to be like, hey, you know, they'll be like, hey, bye, we tried this thing, but what is this fish over here? And we'll grab, oh, it's like this one that you guys have, you know, but it's more commonly used for X.
Yeah.
So that's that one. And then those that come in off the street that are trying to recreate their experience, they're coming with a little bit more of a clean slate. So I feel like they're going to be a lot longer of a conversation in the fact that there's going to be, you're sharing all brands with them. Right. Like, so a typical conversation with somebody like that is going to, I'm going to use like I just got back from a resort in Jamaica experience. Right. Cause it's an easy reference point. So they'll be like, yeah, I just got back from a resort in Jamaica. I had some bomb jerk chicken. You know, I want to do that. So we'd say, well, here we have five brands of jerk seasoning. Here's kind of how they break down in the market. Here are the price points. Here's what I use when I'm making jerk chicken, you know, and then it's more like you offer them a menu, you know, you're like, and I'm going to leave you to make your decision. Right. You kind of just walk away, if you will, from that. And then they're going to like think about it for a while. Right. And they're going to him and haw back and forth. And they're going to ask a couple questions and then they're going to make a buying decision on which one they want. That doesn't happen. Like I said, with the old generation, they're like, oh yeah, I want this champion. That's it. That's the brand I use. Bam, I'm out. Or I'll go on to the next product. So it's very different. But it's fun because it gives you the right, like, it's a balance of like the type of interaction you get with the people in the store.
Yeah. Yeah. And you basically answered like my next three follow-up questions. Out of curiosity, like if you were wondering what they were, I was going to ask, is there a generational divide?
Oh,
what is your marketing strategy?
Mm-hmm.
And then if you see any conversations around brands. So I don't know how you figured that out. I swear, like, to anyone who's listening, I did not send any questions to this. I don't know how the hell you managed to answer the next three. But I think what's interesting is buyer behavior, right?
Yes.
Because this narrative that you talked about, I actually thought up until tonight and in this conversation was something unique to something I've been struggling with, Filipino food. Because what we're finding, and we haven't quite gotten, when I say we, like other people who cook like me, we haven't quite found how to bridge that divide, is we see people who are very married to a certain, like, this is the one way I know how to cook with the one brand that I'm going to
cook.
But if you look further back, right, I think there's this misconception that thinking, so it's a little different from yours where you say it's the second gen, whereas for us, it's mostly like the older people who are like, this is the way to make it. But when we skip past that older generation, which I guess is actually, if you think about it, the second gen here in America,
mm-hmm.
Further back, people are more like what you said, is they meander. They see what's in the market. They, you know, it's a more loosey-goosey, like,
yeah.
Oh, man, like, how do you make it in your town? Or, you know, let me try this out because this is all that's available in the market. But because today we have access to a specific brand 365 days of the year, 24/7, in some cases,
yeah.
It's like, this is it. This is the one way you are allowed to make jerk chicken.
People, you know, I think the interesting thing to just touch on one of those follow-up questions, you know, about is brands are so, they're so strong. And when people come into the store in the generations like myself or, you know, the younger generations, which are so fun to see, like they literally struggle if that brand is gone, like, or like something's out there, like, they're like robots. They're like, oh my God, I don't know what to do next. Like they're on the phone with like their mom. They're like, they're out of Champion. Like there's seven other brands. Like, what do we do? And the funny thing is, I'm like, dude, they're almost all the same, man. Just here's like a good alternative, right? Yeah. Well, no, if I take this one home, you know, like I'm like, dude, it's gonna be okay.
It's the same thing with, I think it's because of the way we've structured recipes nowadays. So it's not just, you know, if you think about a lot of recipes today, they're sponsored. So like if
Noah
or Kraft, they'll say like, oh, use Kraft macaroni with this. And I think we've made a fundamental shift to cooking based on like specific ingredients versus a framework for cooking. Things I think about. Thinking about these specific ingredients and dishes and stuff, is there an issue with Indo-Caribbean food having certain stereotypes? You mentioned jerk chicken, right? Like, do you have the issue where people look at your food and gravitate to like defining it by one dish? Like Japanese have ramen and sushi, and Mexican allies taco seasoning, because that's it. No. They just do taco. Is there an issue like that yet?
No, and that's actually because we haven't really done we struggle with that from the other side, actually. I'll say on a Friday night when I'm kicking it with my friends that are not Guyanese, nobody's like, yo, man, let's go grab some Guyanese food. Right? We haven't mainstreamed or made our food influential or experimental in, like, the average market, to be honest with you. Like, people will be like, yo, let's go get some Jamaican food. Yeah, that happens all the time. I'm just across the street from a Jamaican place right now. But not for like typical Indo-Caribbean food. And if they, so we've actually struggled with that because I was having this conversation with my dad. I was like, Dad, like we even made our food common enough to establish a restaurant. Like we've teeter-tottered with like a restaurant in our store. And I'm like, nobody's going to come in off the street and order that because that's just the stuff that people eat in their house. And then that's the case. People will just cook it at home.
Right, right. So I think basically the same issue that Filipino food had, I think, about like 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know if it, like, and then if you do deviate from it, like it'll, you know, like when you and I were in New York and we were like, we went to get Guyanese food, it was because you're with me, right? So like, you're going to have an experience, but when you look around, most of the people in that place are going to be Guyanese. So we haven't, I'm waiting for the day where I'm floored, where somebody's like, yo, let's have some Guyanese food, you know, otherwise people be like, yo, I do this, right? I'm like, I feel like having Japanese food. And then I'll, you know, immediately I'm thinking like, yo, let's go get some sushi or something, right? Or I'm like, yeah. I want Italian food. I'm thinking I'm going to get some pastas, right? Like, so we categorize it like that, but that doesn't happen for Guyanese people. And like, if I give examples, it's only because I'm Guyanese, so I know enough about it.
Yeah, there's a trade-off where you go through this like mainstreamization, if that's even a term.
We're like, sure it is. It is for today.
Great. We'll gravitate to like one or three stereotypical dishes. And then that's when, like right now, like I think people, yes, they still do say like, let's go get Japanese here in New York. But it's usually like, I want to go to an udon spot. I want to go to an izakaya. You know, like people are starting to go back to that. Almost like this parabola.
Yeah. And there's some restaurants here that are doing a really good job of it. They've gotten some FaceTime, so I think that's good. But I
is Sing still open? I remember like there was a
Sing Marla's is a lot more popular, and that they're related actually, they're brothers and sisters. But so we go to her spot a lot, and she gets a lot of American, a lot of everybody, you know, West Indians, a lot of Black, a lot of white Americans. So she gets a lot of people in her store, and her food I would consider to be very like she doesn't mainstreamize her food, if that's the word, because I mean, her food is authentic. Like, I go there with my brother after work because we're like, yo, this stuff it's just like eating at home, to be honest with you.
Yeah. It's familiar.
Yeah.
I will refrain from using the A word because I know it's a trigger for some people. Though that's a separate conversation. Thinking about perceptions, because you spoke about, like, how you almost reframe the conversations based on who you're speaking with. And now it kind of makes sense why you're really focusing on one store, because I can't see how you would scale that level of thought, especially around conversing with people, if you had
interesting locations, right?
Are there this is a bit of a tangent, but knowing that you've worked at Securian and Target in like various like marketing type roles, are there lessons that you took specifically from your corporate days when you've thought about marketing for your family business?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, and I can even break it down a little bit. I think, at Securian, I learned a lot about fear. In the financial services world, fear is a selling point. It's one position. It's not, so what I mean by that is like life insurance, for example. You buy it because you're scared that when you pass, your family won't have the tools and resources necessary. Now, some people position that as fear, some people position it as making a responsible decision.
Sure.
So there's different ways to position it, but at the end of the day, you're having a conversation about your death and how you want your family to be taken care of. So I think, from that, you've learned that fear drives a lot of purchase behavior, right? It drives behavior in general, right? When you're scared, you start doing things that make sense, or in some cases, don't even make sense. So I learned a lot about it there. I don't have a particular example that I've implemented at our store about fear, other than the fact that, well, actually, this is funny. So I've never connected the fact that I've done this because of my time at Securian, but I will say this. A common thing that we do when we're wholesaling, or even in our store, is like, yo, this shit's gonna run out. No, people will be like, because it's seasonal, right? Like we don't have a lot of farm-raised animal product in our store. A lot of it's wild caught or wild raised. So it's seasonal. Like,
Wait, what? You have wild caught? Where are you sourcing this?
yeah, we source from the Caribbean. Like even just today, I got off the phone with a guy who was like, dude, I don't have any yet because fish only runs when the shrimp run because
Wait,
that's what they
hold
feed
on.
on.
You are getting wild caught animal products flown in from the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Damn it, man. Like, I wish I was cooking in freshman year of college, 'cause that's like the dream. Sorry,
yeah, it's
I interrupted, but
yeah, no,
you were saying
it's
around.
crazy. We don't even realize that, man. I just had this comment with my mom. I was like, Mom, you realize, because I made a comment to somebody, and this is a tangent, but I made a comment to someone who came in our store, and they were like, they're looking for only wild caught stuff, and I could only list two fish that were farm raised, and they're commonly farm raised fish. One is tilapia, right? It's just common fish.
Yes.
So my mom made a comment to me. She's like, "Are you sure about that?" And we were just having a comment. And then today we were like fact checking ourselves, I guess. I was like, "Mom," I walked around. I'm like, "Yeah, can you think of anything else?" Just so I'm right when I talk to people. But I'm like, I don't think anything else in here is actually farm raised. I'm like, I straight up think
Jeez.
it's all cotton. So it's funny how that just kind of like dawned on us. But the point of that is like to bring it full circle in your question, like things will run out, right? Like during particular times of the year, we'll be like, yo, there are 10 packs left. Like you better buy them all right now because you're not going to get it when you come in next week. That is fear, right? Straight up. And that's not me lying to you. I'm just being honest. Like that's going to happen. At Target, I learned, well, to be honest with you, I think my frame up of scale and growth was learned directly from Target. I was
You were
there
doing
when,
business process stuff, right?
and I was there when things started falling apart, if you will. They were scaling. They had gone into Canada and they fell on their face in Canada, if you will. And that was scale. They couldn't manage it. They went too big too quickly without having the operational backbone to manage it, and they exited. Now, I don't consider that a failure from the extent of, you're always learning, but when you look at it from like a financial and an investor perspective, it didn't work.
Right.
And the market didn't take to it. So I think that experience, specifically Canada, and then watching Target kind of shrink itself down, helped me. It was a slap in the face of like, oh, okay, being big isn't always good because you compromise a lot of other things sometimes. And sometimes you're compromising your soul, just to get to that size because you're making deals with the devil,
Yeah, or
you
if
know?
you make a if you scale up an inefficient or worse, a bad
Yeah.
process that in one store doesn't seem like much, but scale that across, it actually ends up being like totally detrimental.
And you're exactly correct. That was my job. That was what I did. I was hired because there was one particular process that in a couple stores didn't make a difference. But when you multiply it over 1,800, we were spending $5 to $10 million in excess a year.
You're almost making the case that everyone should operate small businesses. A bunch of, you know what I mean?
I'm making the case that everybody should think about it that way. And maybe it's hard if you don't. Like, I remember this situation, and this is a true story. We were on our project and we were giving a financial update, and the project lead, the project manager, you know, they're technically responsible for being the one that gives the financial update and does all this stuff. And they're like, well, we should spend this money to use this stuff here. And I was like, why would we do that? That's silly. Like, why don't we just use the money or save the money for something else? And I don't remember what her answer was, but before she could say anything, my question to her was, would you do that with your money? Like, with your business? And she's like, well, this is not my business. And immediately after that, I was
Interesting.
like, I realized that, okay, she's not able to view it from the perspective I am. So basically, this is going to be a moot point because she's not going to be able to agree with me. But what I said to her, I think, was, well, we should think about it that way. Like, I mean, why would I spend them? I wouldn't spend that money if it were my money. So why would I spend it if it's their money? You know, and that's where people wasted money. Like, I sat back and looked at Target and I'm like, man, there are a lot more people operating that way than there are people operating like, yo, this is, you know, this is my money. And there are a lot of people thinking that way. Don't get me wrong, but you get into projects where people are incented to spend the money almost, you know?
Yeah, basically the there's a disconnect in the incentives.
Right.
Wow. I only meant that for that question to be like lessons learned on framing the conversation around food, but somehow you touched on operations and
Yeah.
God damn it, Arun! Like,
Yeah,
you're
yeah,
showing me
yeah.
up on my own show.
Oh man, no.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Since I know we're near the top of the hour, and you talked about like the lessons learned, fast forwarding a bit, right? If we talked about this is your experience back then, this is how you brought it to operations today. What's next? What's next in the next? I don't know how you define the. I don't know how you do your plans, whether it's quarterly, three-year, five-year, 10-year, but. What's next?
I'd like to see us be able to employ a few more people full time, because I really, but people that believe what we believe. And I have a couple of people in mind already, actually. I'm thinking about it. Like, I'm watching some people that work with us part time, and I really want them to be with us full time. And I think there's two reasons for that. One, again, it's not about scale and growing, but it's about being able to serve people more. And right now, we're getting a little stretched, and it's hard for us to devote the mental bandwidth and the physicalness of the job. So we just need some more help, and I'm looking for a couple of people that are really good, and I also want to be a really good employer. We want to pay better than everybody else in the industry, or not everybody else, but we want to pay well. We want people to be able to make a living on it. We want people to be happy. So like, there's some pride and joy in knowing that people look to us for good work. And it's a culture. Like, it's an experience working in our store. Because it is family run and we are having a good time. You know, we're serious, we're not serious, we're kind of trying to balance it all. So I think that's kind of one of the things I'm thinking about. But with that employment opportunity and helping to get some more people to make sure we're doing the work well, then there comes like tightening up our operations a little bit, like expanding our products, making sure that everything is curated well and presented well. I think we have an opportunity with like our store design and how we present food, because there's a huge, and as my dad says, there's a huge opportunity with how we present stuff. Like, we use an analogy all the time. Like, I'm currently, well, I'm dating, but I use that term very lightly, as you know. Like, I'm not in anything serious, but, and this part you don't have to edit out, but I think it's funny because even every weekend when I'm talking with my dad or we're like wrapping fish or presenting fish, he's like, he's always saying this. I think he said it five times on Saturday. He's like, presentation matters, presentation matters. And I always go back to him with, Dad, you didn't think about that the last time you introduced me to some friend of yours' daughter. Like, you know, like if you know, you know, if you know that presentation matters, then why when you show me a picture, you're like, it's not a good picture. Don't do that then, man. Don't do that. So we're comparing apples and oranges, but at the same time, I think the apples and oranges they're both fruits, right? So we're having the same conversation. I'm like, you know, we're talking about it matters how somebody sees this fish presented and wrapped. So much so we actually, and what I mean by doing things better is like, we actually had one of our partners slash competitors, because I believe it's a two-way street, right? They
Sure.
compete with us a little bit, but they're a partner. The guy came in to visit me because we sell product to him, and he actually, I didn't think about this until really now, you know, because it was just processing as natural conversation, but he saw how we wrapped our fish and presented it. And he was like, I need to talk to who wraps this. I was like, my dad's back there right now. you know, he makes sure we all do it the right way. So he had like a half an hour conversation with them on how to properly wrap fish to be displayed in a freezer. And after that conversation, I was at the guy's store visiting with him, and we were dropping off some of the products. And he was like, I remember one thing your dad told me a couple weeks ago that I've been trying to get right here, which is presentation matters. And I think that we fall short sometimes because we're in a rush. And again, hastily work is not good work, right? So I want to get to a place where we all feel like we're in a groove, we're taking our time, we have the right amount of people, we can do the right amount of work, we can present stuff the way we want to, you can have the experience you want to. To cut out some of the obvious questions that people ask me and that you touched on, does that mean having more stores later? Probably not. Does it mean making our store better? Yeah, I'd like to redo our lights. I'd like to look at solar paneling. I'd like to look at the construction of our building. I'd like to look at like how we warehouse stuff to be more friendly. I'd like to look at how quickly we turn product over to make sure it's efficient and we don't waste food, because that's just a sin, you know? Like, those are the kinds of questions that I'm trying to solve for. And if they lead to other things, hey, great. But at this point in time, it's more so it's solving a deeper rooted problem.
Right. And then the presentation one is definitely an interesting one, because like, yeah, there are stores that have literally become successful solely based on, I think I'm thinking more on the restaurant basis, where because the food is beautiful, even though it's like, it tastes all right, it's not bad,
but
the marketing and the presentation is awesome. I cringed a little when you talked about like your dad showing the bad pictures, because I had this image that it just popped in my head and I totally didn't plan for it. Remember when we were in Little Guyana, New York, and we went to this huge fish market?
Yeah.
There was this specific fish that, dude, I'm sorry, man, it looked ugly as fuck. Like, it looked like it had like, it looked like it had like armor. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Hassa. We call it Hassa.
Yeah, it had like several layers of like huge scales. And so when your dad mentioned like showing a picture of a girl, for some reason I had this image of a girl that just had these scales on her. And I'm just like,
it's funny.
They're messing with you.
Yeah, but it's crazy, man, because like you said, like there are things that we you don't think about it, but we like a comment that we get when people walk into our stores, they're like, your store doesn't have any smell.
Like, you told me about that. Yeah.
That's not normal for an ethnic store, right? Like, the perception is you're going to walk in, it's going to smell like fish or smell dirty, right? It's people
poorly,
literally
poorly come lit and yeah.
Right. And like, we just had a guy come in a couple days ago. He like shook my mom's hand. He's like, why, how come this store, it has a smell obviously, but it doesn't have the kind of smell that he's expecting to be hit with. Right. So he was like, I don't understand how you guys even do it. And I'm looking around and I'm like, to be honest with you, I'm not really sure how we do it either. Like, I didn't even know we did anything. It smells to me all the time, you know? But like, that's like, those things are like, they're critical. Like, and that's when you realize like really small things really do matter. And then that's where you shift your, like that, to me, that's where I like, that's where my focus comes from. And that's where our focus comes from, is like, how do we pay attention to these small things? Even though they don't seem small, like just saying hi, making sure doors are open, making sure it's clean. Like, would I shop here?
Yeah.
You know what? I mean, sometimes we think about that a lot. Like, I tell my mom, I'm like, would you come here? Would you buy stuff? Like, would you pay this price? Do you buy this anywhere else? Like, and sometimes the answer is maybe not. You're like, yeah, maybe we should do something differently, because maybe I wouldn't buy that.
Yeah, it's very, I know it's a cliched term that a lot of companies try to throw around today, but being very customer centric.
Yeah.
Entire jobs just looking at how you place your product on your shelf. And I know there's places that will artificially pump this smell of bread. Like, it is about the little things, you know?
Your Cinnabon?
No, at malls, they would sometimes put whatever bakery is leasing the space of the mall, they would put them near the entrances.
Oh, man. Yeah, actually, that's, I don't know if you ever read, I thought you were talking about Cinnabon. Cinnabon's actual strategy, that's how they became iconic. Like, where they are located in a mall and how the air flows through to the mall is a part of their, an integral part. Yeah. I read a story about it or heard about it. The woman who owns Cinnabon, because it's still privately owned, was talking about it. And she didn't, again, it didn't start that way, right? It didn't seem inauthentic. It just answered a question that I always ask myself, which is, I'm in the Mall of America, the biggest fucking mall in the world or in America, and I can smell Cinnabon from like the other end of the, how is that humanly possible? You know, and
good design.
They're like, it's the design, the location, and they do flow. I mean, they're flowing there. It's not artificial. It's their actual, as they're actually baking, but they have fans pointed in directions, right, to get the most airflow. And I don't think that those things, you know, some people will be like, oh, that's shitty. You know, that's really seedy marketing. Yeah.
But you're marketing your actual product.
Right, right, right. And to me, I'm like, that's genius. Right. It's like going into the
genius is if they had to distill that, used a what is it called? The flavor synthesizer.
Yeah.
And,
right.
And actually pump that out. Then yes, that's kind of cheating. Right. But
right. Right. It's like going into a jewelry store, like a store that sells gold, and they're going to have yellow lighting. Obviously, they're going to have yellow lighting because it makes the gold look more gold. Like, that's the way it's going to work. Right. Yeah. Like there are certain things like that that make sense. So I think that, you know, your question was around what's next. I think what's next is really like just looking at these things as like an art and like a design and like a not so much as a commercialization of it, but like I find the artistic side of it's really pulling me in a lot more. And that's where I think there's a little bit of headbutting in my family. And not my dad obviously believes that presentation matters, but I think that I look at store design to be very, very influential. And I think we disagree there because we will constantly go back and forth on the placement of things, specifically like shelves and hallways and like how things are laid out. And there's still some things right now to this day that I hate the way they are. And I think economically they'd actually do better for us. So I try to speak to him in a rational term, but he's not able to let that go for whatever marriage he might have to it. So I've got to figure out, you know, when we'll get there, or maybe he'll just get there on his own.
Might be a interesting strategy, but it's very, when you talk about this being an art, it's almost sounding like if you've seen the Netflix documentary Jiro Dreams of Sushi, it's almost like this incessant chase for how much more can you make this better in this one place.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And but I think we have a great I think we have a great opportunity at it. And I just want to be able to experience it more. Like, I do think that we can do a lot better because we're good. But I think when I look back at it, I'm like, I really want to be there as much as possible and like make sure we're engaged with everything. And I think we find energy from that, you know, like the interactions, the conversations that we have. We'll see. Because we'll see where it all goes.
Yeah. And I wish I knew about it like 3 years ago. I would have definitely loved to hop in on building out the food side.
Yeah, man.
Wanted to close out with some rapid fire questions that I normally ask.
Go ahead.
Everyone who's been on the show, since I know you're sitting in your car and that's why it's abnormally quiet. It makes it easier for me, you know what I mean?
But I can appreciate
being in the car. So the questions are going to be short. You can answer them as short or as long as you wish. Cool?
Cool.
Person who most influenced you from a cultural, marketing, culinary standpoint, whichever one, and why?
My grandmother.
Why?
She reminds me a lot of just being honest and kind of the old school ways that things were done in Guyana. And I travel with her when I'm there. So I see how it's done in the local markets and I love it. Like, I love watching it.
Best kitchen tool you've ever purchased besides the knife?
Oh, I have this plastic, like this whisk. I don't even know how to describe it, but it's made of like this really cool material and it's bright yellow. But I make oatmeal with it, and it makes, like, the best fucking oatmeal ever.
What? It's a whisk. It's basically a whisk.
Yeah, it's a whisk. That basically it is.
Damn, that's a very specific use, man. You must not cook a lot, huh?
Yeah, well, like, I love oatmeal, and it's, like, important that the oatmeal be good.
It's a very specific need. Speaking of cooking, three Indo-Caribbean ingredients to describe you.
That describe me?
Yes.
Wow. Oh, man. That...
You better not say that ugly-ass fish that we saw, man.
No, man. That's crazy. That's such a great question. that I don't even know that I have an answer. I got to think about that for a minute, because like automatically when you asked me the question, my mind gravitated towards like something like cumin.
Oh, okay.
So I immediately thought spice, and to answer the question of why I think cumin, like it's got such a like robust flavor and sense of character.
Yeah.
And I think that way about myself, honestly. Yeah. So that's the answer to that one. I would.
Doesn't have to be spice, by the way. It could be anything.
Well, no, and that's funny. I'm trying to answer the reason I'm struggling to answer the question is I'm wondering why my mind is only thinking about spices, and I don't know why it is. I just seem to be categorizing myself kind of like in that area, but I think provisions, what we call provisions, which by definition means it's kind of like a category of like rooted vegetables. So like sure. Cassava, plantain, edos, those are what we call provisions. Okay. And I think the description to me would be they're earthy. They're basic, they're foundational foods. They're like bottom of the food chain.
Sure.
And I think when I think about myself, I think it's like having a strong base, a strong foundation. It's healthy eating. It's good for you. And the last thing would be chocolate.
It came like, out of nowhere.
Yeah. Straight out of nowhere. I'm immediately thinking about this. Two chocolates specifically that we eat, that I eat at, from our store. One is a caramel bar, which is from, it's like a chocolate wafer bar, okay. Super popular amongst, kids, which is why like anybody that eats it, thinks about it, has a nostalgia to their childhood. Like it's what kids come and grab. So I think for me, it reminds me of like every time, like any kid that can walk comes in, we actually put it in arm's reach of the kids. They grab it. And it's so fun to watch it. Like, but the relationship with me is that it reminds me of like being childish and like being a kid and not worrying or caring about all the things that we worry and care about that are consumed by our being an adult, if you will. So that's not exactly actually a description of like me characteristically, but I think it is when you apply the filter of it's somebody that I'm trying to balance being a child and being an adult.
Hey man, this is a very good answer. Actually, to be honest with you, I used to ask this question as three something something spices. I used to ask spices. So the fact that you gravitated towards spices maybe means I should stick back to the spice question. Though I think it's a valiant effort that you tried to name non-spices. Although I would have thought that you would have said rum.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah.
One book / documentary / I don't know, whatever kind of resource that you would give to the common person for what you do, whether that's marketing or retail or something. Just one book that you think like, man, this is required reading.
Oh, Economics 101. Pick up any economics book.
Really? Economics? Why?
A textbook. I think that everything boils down to supply and demand. It's fundamental, right? This isn't complicated, mm-hmm. right? So I actually, believe it or not, I do this all the time. And there's an economics book that I got, you know, from my beginning economics classes. It sits at my bedside. And every now and again, I will open it up and just read a section.
Is this what you're not dating, bro? Because this,
come on, man. Oh, man. You might have just solved that problem, man. You might have just solved that
problem. Move the book to the living room.
Yeah, instead of I put my iPhone there and my Tinder app open, right? Like, but it's serious, man. Like, economics can explain, to bring it, you know, to close this out with like the beginning of the conversation, like
yeah.
Economics can explain a lot of behavior, and there's so much to be understood in the simple graphs and concepts of why things are the way they are designed and how things work in society from an economics perspective. So like, but it's basic economics, right? We're not talking about like huge formulas and complex algebra. We're just saying like you have a graph and you have a line and you're just trying to figure out a very simple answer. Sure. You can synthesize it that way.
Sure. So last question, this is going to be a split part question. The first one is one lesson that you would give to someone who's either trying to promote their own food or serve their own community. That's the first part. Let's answer that one first and then I'll go.
Care about it like it's your own child.
The second part is if someone had to write the book about Galaxy Foods, starring Arun, they had one page. They could only write one line. Like, this is the whole story of Galaxy Foods in one line. What would the one line be?
Oh. Authentic Caribbean.
Nice. Nice. You didn't even finish the whole sentence. You didn't do a phrase. I like it.
Yeah.
Wow. Usually at the end of the day, like, coming in from work, I'm honestly like super tired. But, man, my mind is just like racing now.
So is mine. I'm like ready to get the phone and call somebody else to start talking.
Right, which is good because usually we have these conversations usually when I'm over there or you're over here in New York. So yeah. I'm always glad that I don't think we've had a basic quote unquote conversation ever.
Yo, bro, I might be coming out to New York in a little bit, actually, in a couple months. So I'll let you know.
What would be interesting is I think if we do a follow-up episode, we'd get someone else with me.
Yeah.
Who's kind of like an opposing thought, and ooh, kind of just a round table with rum, you know what I mean? And just because I think what's missing right now in our podcast, because all our podcasts have been topical, so even this right now we've focused mostly on operations and marketing. Yeah. But what would be interesting is if we take a topic that's very broad around food, so let's say food from third world countries, and just debate the hell out of it from
man,
from history, from, you know,
woo,
I mean?
Let's do it.
But we'll wait till you get here, because I don't think I'll be going there anytime soon.
Nobody man. Is. I might be coming this fall, actually. So.
Ah, perfect, perfect.
Yeah.
We'll go to Little Guyana, get some shark patties or something.
Yeah, man. Let's do it. Let's do it.
Well, sir, thank you again for your time.
Oh, man.
We didn't
always
have too much time of you cooped up in the car, if it's a Maserati or otherwise. Let's just pretend it is, yeah?
Nice. Yeah, man. Pretending is okay with me.
All right. Thank you, sir. You have a good
night. Yeah, man.